I was thinking this morning as Mike was talking about his seminary days. I taught at a Christian college for 6 years, and my role there was to train pastors, which I thoroughly enjoyed that role. It was one of the kind of joyous times of my life. All of my times are joyous, but I really did enjoy that. And I was on the edge of being fired at all times. But one of the things that I would say to my students, I say, now it's really, to me, very important that you not just be here listening and taking notes. You really do need to be involved locally. You need to be doing something with this, testing everything I say out to see whether or not this really flies. I said, if you don't, what happens is you're 4 years here, taking in, and you get a case of spiritual constipation. Then you're going to go to your first pastorate and have a movement. That will take them years to clean up. Causes us to believe the Bible is that it tells the truth about its heroes. Have you noticed that? I mean, to be a hero in the Bible is to have your life pretty well laid out. Makes me kind of glad I'm not a hero of the Bible. You would know things about me I wouldn't necessarily want you to know. Well, there's one particular hero that through the years of my life, and I'm a church kid, I have heard many people tell me that, even heard a pastor on the radio just recently say this, that in this man's life I have found no mistake that he made, no sin. And I'm thinking, that's funny, I know three right off the bat. I'm talking about Joseph. Now, to talk about Joseph, you've got to back up just a little bit, don't you? You see, one of the buzzwords of our day is dysfunctional families, which happens to be all of us. And one thinks, well, how can you expect anything good to come from a dysfunctional family? You can't. But the Lord can do just about anything. And he takes an Isaac and Rebecca, who Isaac really loved Esau. I mean, Esau stunk like the field. Gary. And that was his boy. Hey, his brother, Jacob, nice and smooth. Mama's boy. Now, Falcons were not scouting Jacob, only Esau. Now, the thing is, to name a kid Jacob, he doesn't really have a chance anyway. Loosely translated, it means dirty, sneaky thief. My parents named me Gail. But how would you like to go to school with a name like that, and they call the roll? Dirty, sneaky thief? Yeah. You you grow up and go to the bank to get a loan to go into business, and your name, sir, dirty, stinky people. Huh? Now, the fact is, Jacob lived up to his name. Dirty, stinky thief, his brother Esau out of the birthright with the help of his mother. What a family. After God, he's a family. I don't know. So he has to leave home now, and he runs off to live with his uncle Laban, who was just like him. These two guys deserved each other. It's like the two men with the world's worst driving record colliding, you know. They deserved each other. And for 20 years, they dirty, sneaky, thieved each other to a fare thee well. Well, though Jacob, young buck that he was, his eyes fell upon Rachel. And he says, Laban, I want Rachel. Really? She's available. 7 years later, and she's here. Oh, she's good. Seven years of labor rolls around, and on the morning after his marriage, he awakens to discover, I must have been drunk. That's Leah. The Bible is mercifully quiet about Leah, except that she was older. Now, that meant that if Rachel was of marriageable age, Leah was actually beyond it. And there would always be a reason. One of the moments in my son's life where, you know, two or three times in his life, he's come out with brilliant statements. And we were traveling along together and from the car observed one of those gorgeous mountain views. And I said to him, son, this is all the proof you need that evolution is not true, because there's no evolutionary reason why we should think that was beautiful. Beauty in and of itself is not an evolutionary concept. And then he made this profound statement. He said, you know, Dad, I bet that the concept, though, of beauty in human beings is a result of the fall. Because you see, to God, everyone is beautiful. He did not die for the tall and handsome only. He included short, fat, bald, ugly, suspender-wearing man. But we divide people up, don't we? We've got the beauty queens, you know, and we've got the passable, and we've got the junkyard dogs. And the world divides them up that way, don't we? But God doesn't. And I am so glad that we do. And Leah had not made the cut. But now, man, you got to see Jacob. He's bound to be absolutely upset. It's supposed to be Rachel. Wow, I forgot to tell you about what a rule we have here. I don't know how we forgot that, but the oldest always married first, and what can I say? But if you want to wait, Rachel. Man, this guy, Laban, was shocked. 7 more years. Now, of course, finally he has Rachel. Now, this is the sort of thing Hollywood makes the most out of, doesn't it? Oh, such a beautiful love story. But here, the jewel after whom he seeks, he's willing to wait 14 years. And clearly though the fruition of his desires come. Oh, isn't it sweet? And they ride off into the sunset to the sound of music. Hollywood puts that together, doesn't it? But interestingly enough, in that day, the one thing that made a woman's life complete was that she had children. Too bad, Rachel. Your womb is closed. But he's the one she wants. He's the one he wants the hardest for, man. Leah's putting him out. Respect that. The most interesting thing is said that gives me some insight into the very heart of God. When God saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb. Now, you know, the way we would tend to see things in the romanticism of our day, oh, the 13 years of work for Rachel means that the messianic line must be coming through Rachel. But it didn't. Through Leah. Ugly Leah. This because now we have another dysfunctional family. You know, just to shorten it up here, we've got an unloved mother with all the kids. We've got a loved Rachel, no kids, worthless in their society, except to Jacob. But now let's rejoin Jacob after a little encounter with an angel that would have been, a pretty fleshly appearance of Jesus, an epiphany, if you please. That ended up as a bit of a draw, but finally this angel cripples Jacob. So now, in a sense, Jacob's as ugly as anybody else. You know, here he is walking along. He can't make a living. Back then, children were wealthy. And so the more children you had, the wealthier you were, because man, if you had a son, we got more help in the field now. We made a lot more money. If you had a daughter, praise the Lord, we got help in the kitchen. By the way, you know, when this was more of an agrarian society in our country, when a child was born, it was needed and wanted, and it knew it. If it was a boy, got help in the field. If it was a girl, got help in the house. That's changed now in our more urban society. When a child is born, oh brother, we were doing really good and this thing's taking over. We were having fun. Now we have to take care of this thing. Cries all night, gets in my way. Can't even watch the football game. And the child is not needed, and it knows that. Maybe that's why juvenile delinquency was more a product of urbanization. But now we're around a table, shall we say, filled with a bunch of strapping men and a crippled daddy whose success depends on those guys. I wonder what the conversation was like. Dan, I know your name has changed to Israel, but how come God keeps calling you Jacob? Why did they call you Dirty Sneaky Pete? Tell us of some things you've done. What's the last great cheat you pulled? Because when you really look at the life of Jacob, folks, he really didn't do much, did he?
I mean, no great writings.
He basically lived up to his name. And yet God chose to identify himself. This is fascinating to me. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and dirty sneaky thief. I can hear more questions. Daddy, why don't you love our mother? Daddy, why don't you love me? We were grown, Dad, when Joseph came along, you know, finally. Rachel had one. Big deal. We're making it a living. Why don't you love us? I'd like to grow up in that kind of family. Man, you're so happy you had one, but this wife whom you love, that you got him as fancy duds, man. I don't know if you paid much attention to the fashions of Afghanistan. But it's like you've seen one, you've seen them all. And that would have been the way with these guys who were shepherds. You've seen one, you've seen them all. Oh, but Joseph, the son of his old age. You see, God had mercy on Rachel. Oh, by the way, in the meantime, even Leah's womb would shut up for a while. And Leah, who knew children was her only hope, said, "Here, take my handmaiden." Jacob said, "All right." And even Rachel says, "Man, I don't have any children here. Take my handmaid." And Jacob goes, "All right." That's the family. And Benjamin comes along, and Rachel dies at his birth. And so Jacob is stuck with the one wife he does not love. And as she was dying, the one he did love, Rachel, she names this last son Ben-Oni, which means the son of my trouble. And Jacob says, "No way." Names him Benjamin, the son of my right hand, my strength. Now listen, folks, this is a little crude, but you got to understand. He's real old now. And when he says, "the son of my right hand, my strength," well, you know what he's saying? "I can still do it." And these two guys he really loves. Well, you know, Joseph and the other guy didn't get along too well. They wouldn't speak a kind word to each other. And Joseph got even. He'd come home tattle. And one day when got up, I guess, and said to everybody, "Got to tell you some dreams I had. Hey, guys, I was out with you fellas and we were gathering wheat and my shock stood up and yours bowed down to me. What you think of that?" Then he says to mom and dad and all of them, "Oh, this dream, man, the sun and the moon and the stars bowed down to me." Now, this is early on. He's 17 years old. I was 17. Well, I'm still 17. It's just a horrible thing that's happened to my body. And there was still what you might call a lack of old maturity. Sometimes there are dreams and visions we have that are not necessarily designed for advertising. But a 17-year-old whose older brothers are constantly picking at him is probably not going to show a whole lot of maturity. And this is all self-centered. You're going to bow down to moi. You know, Paul had a vision that was so great that he had to have a thorn in the flesh given to him to keep him from being elevated or conceited or lifted up above his brothers. Now, we don't know what it was, but the fact that it kept him from being conceited gives us a first clue. It had to be something that was embarrassing. Keep him off of television, you know. We have a further clue that it might have been his eyes, you know, that probably constantly ran like a snotty nose, you know, and you look at him and go, oh, Paul, wipe your eyes. Making me sick. We know that his voice was weak. You know, he brings it up because the Corinthians complained about that. Oh, you're weak when you're here. I mean, so he might have had a really squeaky and irritating voice, and his eyes were running like snotty nose all the time. Legend tells us he was short and hunchback. So here he is saying, hello. I am your apostle. By the way, there were others, you know, running around at that time claiming to be apostles who looked and acted more like them, you know. They were tall, handsome, great voices, hair swept back and ready for television. And suppose you're with Paul and one of these, and you, which one do you want to introduce to your friends?
Hello.
Hi. But I'm telling you this really just to tell you that it was 14 years after that vision before Paul told about it. Isn't that something? If I had a vision like Paul's, you'd know tomorrow. I'd start the Gail Irwin Vision Ministries in preparation. So you see, something is happening here. We're seeing the results of dysfunctional family. We're seeing the results of typical humanity. And we're seeing a young man whom God has given a great dream, a great vision to, and he's not mature enough to do anything except, hey guys, you get to bow down to me. Ain't it great? Well, you know the story, don't you? One time when his dad sends him out, go find out where your brothers are. Hadn't heard from them in a while. And when he goes out hunting them, they see him coming from a distance. I mean, with a coat like he had on, you don't look like the rest of the people. And they decide, let's kill him. And one of them rescues him. I think it was Reuben who kept him from killing him. And instead, they throw him in this cistern, in this dungeon. Take his clothes, rip it, cover it with blood, take it back to Dad. And the big lie begins. Now, our first view of Joseph is a very self-centered sort of thing. He's nicely dressed, better than his other brothers, which of course brings an awful lot of attention to himself. He has the dream of dreams, glad to report it to all of you, which of course is centered in himself. Now he's in this cistern, kind of a jail, if you please, a dungeon not built for one, but handy. Now suppose you had a great vision. Suppose that God called you to where you are. Just suppose. And you really feel, hey, I'm here because I believe God sent me here. And the next thing you know, everything's dark and there's just a little bit of light above you. And you figure, my days are numbered. And you're thinking, you know, this isn't what I had in mind. This does not fit my dream at all. When God told me this, he didn't tell me that. don't raise your hand, but have you noticed that God, when he called you, didn't tell you everything? It gets to the point that when he talks to you, you're almost ready to say, could I have a second opinion? But now, something happened in that system. I don't know what it was, but something changed him in there. When everything has suddenly gone wrong, and now you're no longer dad's favorite, as far as dad's concerned, you're dead. And the brothers who hate you are in control of your destiny. The only thing you have to hang on, the only thing you have to hang on to is what God has said. That's it. Not one circumstance surrounding you, not one, is an encouragement. I want less than the fact that you're at least not dead yet. So I figure there was some maturing that went on, and however long he was in that cistern, however long it took for that caravan heading for Egypt to come by, Joseph grew up. When we see him coming out of this, he is no longer, in my view, the self-centered Joseph. You see, that's the opposite of the very nature of Jesus. Now, from this point on, we see him becoming a guy who helps others. Now, I happen to believe that his first big mistake, and I see this as that, is the way he advertises his dreams to his brothers and his family. Designed for hostility, designed for self-centeredness, would have been still a true dream had he chosen to reveal it in less hostile ways. But I think he made a serious mistake with that. Sometimes it takes a cistern or a dungeon or something that seems to totally destroy every dream we ever had for us to grow up and really trust God. In fact, I've come to the point in life where I say, I don't want anyone counseling me who has not suffered. Because if you've suffered, then you're going to be gentle with people. If you haven't, you'll be harsh. And those who have suffered greatly are often the most careful with human beings because they know how painful life can be, and they don't want to add to the pain. It's one reason I think when Jesus said, don't try to take a splinter out of your brother's eye when there's a log in yours. Now, that's an incredible illustration. I don't know if you've ever had a log in your eye, but if you ever have had a log in your eye, he says, first go and remove the log. Imagine it. Pain. Then you will see clearly. You know, anybody who's had a log removed is going to be real careful with eyes. So Joseph comes out of here. Now he's a slave. He's been sold for a rather prophetic amount of money. In fact, we even view Joseph as a type of Christ, don't we? Because here he is, sold for that amount of money, betrayed by his brothers, off to a strange land where everything goes against him. Man, he's bought by Potiphar, and he makes Potiphar prosper. In fact, this guy is now so reliable that Potiphar turns his whole household over to him. He says, man, I trust you. But you see, there was a wife there that really liked the looks of this strapping Jewish boy. And anyway, Potiphar's not here, you know. And who knows what he does when he's gone. Hey, Joseph. Now, if Joseph had been like his brothers, his ancestry, he would have said, all right. But no. See, something had happened to him now. And rather than think of his own pleasure, he had become now a person interested only in integrity and the welfare of his employer. even at the price of his freedom. And you know that? She cheated on him, claims that he raped her. He gets thrown in jail. Now, I don't know how things have gone for you in your ministry. What kind of claims that people have made about you, and whether you thought, well, okay, look, they threw me in the cistern, and okay, but I'm doing okay. I'm eating well here at Potiphar's house. It's got to get better. And then it gets worse. Oh, man. From slave to jailbird. Well, you do so good in jail, though. You see, a lot of times when people are in prison, all they think about is how I've been framed, I've been messed with, you know, and so forth. I get letters from prisoners. Some of them are really good ones, but a number of them will tell me, they don't just flat out say, man, am I ever in a place I deserve to be in? But they have the story, you know, of why they're not really supposed to be there. And some of them, that's true, but nonetheless, we know Joseph didn't deserve to be there. And so, at a certain point, he interprets a dream for a couple of guys. A butler and a baker. And the butler, he says, you're going to go back to your position. You're going to be the king's chef, his wine taster, and so forth, the place of trust. And to the baker, he says, they don't chop your head off in a day or so, buddy. So we know he was honest. And he says to the butler, hey, when you're back up there, remember me, will you? And the butler didn't. Oh, man. Have you ever got to the point in your preaching where you thought, man, these people, I have preached to them, and I have preached to them, and they still sinning. They're not listening to me. You heard the story, of course, of the one guy who preached the same sermon every Sunday, about 10 weeks, every Sunday, same sermon. Finally, they came to him and said, when are you going to quit preaching that same sermon? He said, when do you quit committing that same sin? But finally, you know, they turned the jail over to him because he's such a faithful guy, you know. And then all of a sudden, because of a dream of Pharaoh, the butler remembers, oh, I forgot. Joseph Dutton knows this is going on. He has no reason to think anything's working right, except he has that one word of God to hang on to. Not much, eh? Just the word of God. Keep in mind that Adam and Eve, all they had was the word of God in the garden, and much better surroundings than Joseph had. Well, of course, he interprets the Pharaoh's dream. He is now out of jail and now in charge of the kingdom. Amazing. I want you to look at something for just a second and keep this in mind, because I call this the Joseph principle. You know, usually, equationally, we say A plus B equals C. In other words, if this happens, this happens, this is the meaning, this is the result. But you see, Joseph was seeing things through a different lens, I believe, because when this happened and this happened, he saw it through the lens of somehow God's going to win in this. I don't know. He didn't tell me that. In fact, I don't think I'll ever eat pickles before I go to bed again. But I know that God said this, so I'm going to assume that as bad as this is, it doesn't equal C out here. It equals something else. I don't know what it is, but I'm not going to let it turn me into a bitter or misinterpreting or discerning person. So each time things got worse for Joseph, he continued to exhibit now the same integrity. Awesome. Well, you know, part of the dream was that he interpreted for Joseph, you're going to have 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of great famine. And we need to collect during the great time, so we'll have for the famine time. And you might take note that it was seven fat cows and then seven lean cows. And folks, in the Bible, skinny is always a bad symbol. Always. Fat is always a good symbol in the Bible. God even says, the fat is the Lord. He even says, let your soul delight itself in fat. So he's come through all of this with the right attitude, and now finally, after all that has happened, very, not just humbling, but humiliating times, he has come to a moment of exaltation, which is why, one of the reasons why we sort of see him as a type of Christ, you see. Through this great suffering, he's come to this great time of exaltation, and he is blessing a whole nation. He's become its Savior. And keep in mind that back in Genesis earlier, in Genesis 12, God had made a promise to and a covenant with Abraham. It was not a covenant that Abraham deserved. God just picked him out. Abraham wasn't a believer to begin with, but when God picked him out and said, I'm going to do this, Abraham believed. Abraham saw Jesus' day and was glad. He rejoiced in it. It really is a concept of he leaped for joy when he saw Jesus day and he believed God. God called that righteousness. And one of the incredible blessings, parts of the covenant, was in you all the world will be blessed. Wow. Here's Joseph, part of that line, blessing the known world. Causing Pharaoh not just to prosper, but to come to own the entire land. Incredible. Now, why doesn't Egyptian history tell us this? Well, let me tell you, folks, we have this naive view of history. You see, we write nice history books about our great presidents and so forth, and George Washington must have been a type of Christ because he was so perfect. But now, you see, we're beginning to realize, as others dig in, that he wasn't that nice a guy, necessarily. In fact, I've been around for several presidents. Now I long for the government to be on his shoulders, you know. But you see, back then, when these countries would change from one dynasty to another, they would erase the history of the prior dynasty. They didn't build on their heritage. Their heritage was themselves. So anything that had to do with prior, they would erase it. And let me tell you, they never would write about a defeat of theirs. You know, like when they sang with David, Saul has killed his thousands, David's killed his 10,000s. And that's a great victory march. Nobody ever writes songs. And boy, did they whip us. We were a mess when they got through with us. We lost that war so bad. And it's never, such a song never makes it to the top of the charts. We was whipped. Now, we might say we was robbed, but never was. And so it's quite understandable. I personally think, as I look at archaeology and what have you, that probably the greatest of the buildings that occurred during some of the Pharaonic dynasties was a result of the Jewish people building it as slaves. They made bricks, you know. Well, at any rate, it was not a foreign country that wrote the story of Joseph. It was God who wrote the story of Joseph. And it may never be that a foreign entity or your you'll never see that in the headlines of your newspaper, and it won't be them that'll write your history. But I love the fact that in Malachi, it says, and those who feared the Lord talked to one another, and the Lord listened and heard, and a scroll of remembrance was written in his presence of those who feared his name. I like that. Well, time comes when the famine is so bad that up in Israel, up with the children of Israel, looks like they're going to die. It's all over just about. And finally, Jacob sends his boys down. We got to go, man. We got to go get some food. And when they show up, they don't recognize Joseph. You know that. But he recognizes them. Now, I'm going to tell you my opinion of this next few events. Joseph was mean. He toyed with his boys. Now, I've heard people say, but they deserved it. Well, yes, they did. They deserved worse, but then aren't you glad you don't get what you deserve? He was not at this moment being a type of Christ. He was being mean to these guys. He could just as easily have said to them, hey, I think you're spies, but the proof that you're not, just go home, get your whole family and bring them down here. And when they did, he could have revealed himself to them. It would have been a glorious thing. They'd still been terrified. But it would have been a simple thing. But no, he's going to toy with them. And finally, by his sneakiness, that's not considered his second great mistake. He says, if you don't bring your brother with you, you will not see my face. Now, I consider that kind of a classic line. He's talking about Benjamin. I almost hear the Lord saying to us about that in terms of our fellowship with each other. We're not alone in the kingdom. We are not islands. And if we don't bring our brother with us, we're not likely as likely to see his face. One of my favorite songs from the Jesus Movement days, which I think are still here, is that part that says, use your own two hands. With one, reach out to Jesus, and with the other, bring a friend. I like that. And that's one reason I love these gatherings that we have, because we are saying, I'm part of you, and I love the fellowship, and there's not a one of you here. The governor is not here. The mayor is not here. Who are you? Just promised a quality crowd. If ever there were a collection of nobodies, we did it. Don't raise your hands, but how many of you have had someone, usually another pastor, or where did you get your training? What seminary are you a product of? And it's kind of hard to answer that, because you know you're being put down. And you're thinking, well, I'm reading right. And the word processor has a spelling program. I got to tell you this story right quick. Back when I was teaching at this college, Christian College, one of the courses I taught, it was called Ministering in Death and Dying. And it kind of became my favorite because it was very powerful, because we all tend to die at some point or other, you know. So it's kind of, and I had gotten hold of some videotapes from University of Washington in Seattle that were of the death of the director of the Department of Medicine of their medical school. He had developed stomach cancer, and he asked them to just take him through, he was going to die. Take him through his death. Tell him everything going on, all of the stuff that surrounded him. It was awesome. And they filmed his family, and the caregivers, and I've never heard or seen doctors so honest. If they sat there in this film and said, well, you know, he was an impossible patient. Because he knew that we didn't know. And we couldn't kill him. If we said we're going to prescribe this, he'd say, why are you going to do that? You know, this doesn't work. All this does is do that, and that just makes me stupid in the middle of it. No. Oh, yeah. So he knew that we didn't know, which is incredible, you know, admission that we don't know. But one thing that I shall never forget, and I love this part of those tapes, they filmed the religious caregivers. Now, this doctor happened to be a member of one of the standard band churches, you know. Not one of the kinds that ever has to rent a warehouse or go to a shopping center or buy an airplane hangar or a boat storage building or something like that. And the pastor was in this film and very finely dressed, very distinguished looking, obviously a man of letters. But seated next to him was this, oh, maybe he was 22, dressed like me. How old am I? He was the gardener. Amazing that he's in that film as a spiritual caregiver. And this man of the letters would, in his comments every once in a while, make reference to the fact that for those of us who are trained, and it was so obvious, this kid's there and he never even noticed he was insulted. They just insulted you. I call it the PPT view of life. I don't think there's some other reason why people are. But you see, the fact was that this gardener had been their main service of help. You ready for this? He was a Calvin Chapel guy. And when he found out that the head of the house that he gardened was dying, man, he's coming in and talking to them, praying for them, bringing them out of music for them to listen to, reading the Bible to them, leading them to the Lord. However, he was untrained. Yeah. Well, whoever I was before I kicked that rabbit down the field, I thought. Joseph, yeah! Joseph! Joseph Pleasure, there are a couple of things I want you to see in here. One is, at one point, when he wants Benjamin to come, of course, Jacob is absolutely against. No way. Reuben's the first man. It would seem that if you're going by the traditions, Reuben, that first one, should be the carrier of the line. Reuben says, Dad, look, let's take Benjamin, and if we don't return with him, you can kill my two boys. Now that's kind of like the lady that picked her sensitive little boy to school for the first time and said to the Bradley went and sends them in, and then the most interesting thing occurs. You know, there's a problem with them, and this time he has them hide his weapons and give them their money back to them, and I can't scare them, so this time he says, I want you to hide my cup. Benjamin's cup. Yeah, I'm going to go church. I'm going to church. I don't know if you love me. We bought the hunt back today. You can check everything we've got here. Really, you can't. Listen, just take it.
All right, we're going to do it.
I'm not going in this airport to be looking at me. They're going to mess up the hunt. I have too much fun to pass this conference. Well, just a couple of other things I've got to quit because I ran out of time 30 minutes ago. When boys bring down, you know, they bring the whole family down, and it's a book. Don't even bring your clothes, don't bring your cooking stuff. You don't have the best food. You don't even need a higher U-Haul or anything. Just come. And then he says this most interesting thing. I have a couple brothers. If one of them were present, I'm a name doctor. I would be saying things like this. I mean, it would be advertised, and then you'd be involved, and you would have President Biden. And I would be telling you the other day when he called me and wanted you to know, I wanted to know how to win the picture. I would do that. And here is the number one guy in the country. I mean, it would only be logical. the brothers of the king and a half. But Joseph does not do that. He asks you who you are to him. They're just a bunch of shepherds.
Now, why do you want to say that?
Is that like real stuff? No, it's not.
Almost like me to a man could take the Lord's sick, right?
It's almost like I have been lowly in my life. Right? It's almost like the way Jesus comes. He says, you're telling me you should put this food. When the dog comes, don't pop me in. $500
Blip.
All right. Well, you know the rest of the joke. Turn on the dip. Is being despised. That's what's a vanity disaster, because it means that we have to lean on God. What a bad thing. Then the final thing. When Dad dies, the guys are terrified now. Boy, now Joseph is going to get his gun. And we see sort of the core and culmination of the Joseph principle when he says, look, guys, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That many lives could be saved. And that's the way it is in our lives, folks. There are going to be a lot of people that were meaning evil, but God never wastes anything. He has no garbage dump. Everything that happens to us, every difficulty, He has ways of using it that would keep you in awe. Just don't stare at the cistern walls too long. Don't stare at your jail box. Don't read the reports in the newspaper about yourself too much. And don't listen to your banker. Is the last word, because when others mean it, they're evil. And so we just happen to have this incredible promise of God, all things. And how many things might that be? Okay. Work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to His purpose, and go on and said, so that we can be made conformable, to make us like Christ. That's the whole point. So it's everything that makes us like Christ. All right. So, yeah, Joseph, you weren't perfect, but here's good to read about you and to get some lessons from you. Thank you. Amen.